Hi everyone, I'm Dominique.
And I'm Adriana, and we are Survivor Sisters.
Survivor Sisters is a podcast that shares the stories of sexual assault survivors to educate, empower, and inspire other survivors and their peers to take action against sexual assault. For today's episode, we are sitting down with some lovely ladies from Callisto, which is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to create technology that combats sexual assault, supports survivors, and advances justice. At Callisto, they believe that survivors should be recognized as autonomous agents over their actions and given a world of options to choose from as they navigate their healing journeys and journey to justice. Callisto created a repeat perpetrator detection system that allows individuals who have experienced sexual assault to securely create an encrypted entry of their incident into their matching system, in addition to various other resources that they have listed on their website. Our two guests for today are Dr. Antonia Franco and Maya Brockbank. Dr. Franco is Callisto's chief executive officer. Her career has spanned over 20 years of executive and management experience in the nonprofit, philanthropic, and government sectors, advancing access, equity, and a voice for marginalized communities. And Maya Brockbank currently serves as a campus partnership intern for Callisto. She's also currently a senior at Stanford University, where she has also served as the co-director of sexual violence prevention within Stanford Student Leadership, and is also responsible for helping organize the National Student Alliance Against Sexual Violence, which is a national coalition of student sexual violence prevention and Title IX advocates coordinating on local, institutional, and national efforts to uplift survivors and respond to the Department of Education's recent Title IX regulations. Thank you both for being here. We're so excited to talk to you today and to learn more about Callisto and, you know, kind of open up this conversation surrounding technology and sexual assault advocacy work.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for letting us be here. This is an awesome opportunity.
So we really wanted to record this episode not only to learn more about Callisto, because we believe that it can be a really valuable resource to a lot of our audience, but also to, like I said earlier, open up that conversation around technology and activism and advocacy work. That's something that we have been seeing since the start of the pandemic. We've seen a huge increase in our reliance on technology in all aspects of our life, from work to education to socializing, et cetera. And especially with the events of last spring and into summer, in the Black Lives Matter movement and other social justice movements, we saw a huge reliance on social media and technology to advance our activism and advocacy and to educate others on these movements. So we feel like it's also a perfect time to include sexual violence and domestic violence, and particularly for us, sexual assault on college campuses, into that conversation. And as Callisto being a tech startup nonprofit, we think that they're the perfect people to talk to about this and get their perspective in this conversation. But before we kind of dive into all of that, I would like to just start by having Antonia introduce Callisto and their services a little bit more, and just kind of how Callisto came to be and where are we now, and the different services and resources that Callisto currently offers students and survivors.
Great. I'm happy to do that. Callisto started in 2011 by Jess Ladd, who is the founder and also a sexual assault survivor. And over the years, it has evolved in terms of the support and the product. And in its most recent formation, the product is such that survivors can go to our website, and if they so choose, they can actually create an account and, you know, create an online record form. Right now it's downloadable, but we do are working towards making it online. They can also enter matching, right? If they feel comfortable being able to identify their perpetrator and put those unique identifiers within our system. The one thing I do really want to underscore is that we have evolved as an organization, and the product has been developed by the voices of survivors, right? So gaining their feedback throughout the entire process and refining it to make sure that we are being really thoughtful about it, and that it's not re-traumatizing, and that they have agency to move through this process the way they feel is best for them. And so our site is secure and confidential, and only the survivor has access to their information. We don't even have access to their information, and that's how we want it, right? And only at a time if a survivor chooses to enter into matching and there is a match with another survivor, they can be assigned to a legal options counselor. And this is a lawyer that is working with us that has experience with Title IX rules and regulations, and also has experience working with sexual assault survivors. I also want to underscore that it's the survivor decides if they even want to talk to the legal options counselor, if they want to know further, right? It's really on their time. And if they so choose, they can say no, and that's it. If they choose to come back and decide later, that's really up to them as well. And also, I want to underscore that we have really amazing interns like Maya and others that are working with us to make sure that we're relevant and that what we're doing is right by and for our survivors. And so they have a huge, you know, role in giving their perspective and being a part of the process. I think the other thing too is that we also have a list of resources on our website. So everyone starts at a different place. And so it's not up to us to decide how you start or where you start, but it's to say, here are a list of resources and you explore it the way that you want to and need to for yourself. And so, you know, we want to just be there to be supportive, provide the resources, and then guide them along as they so choose. I'll pause there and I'll ask Maya if she wants to add anything else that I may have missed.
I think that was pretty thorough and comprehensive, but I'm happy to speak on sort of individual points of that as the conversation goes on.
Yeah, I mean, what we really loved about Callisto and just learning about it before we, you know, obviously decided to partner and create an episode together was that there have been changes that have been made to the platform that really takes in the survivor's perspective and their point of view, which is so important in any nonprofit organization that's going to, you know, exist within this space. It's so important to be survivor-centric and in the case of college campuses, to be student-centric as well, to just take into account the different issues that may arise with certain things and to just acknowledge that while we're here as a resource, there's many other resources that exist and there's many different avenues that you can take that may not necessarily be entering into the matching system, but it may be, you know, filling out the record form or, you know, taking advantage of the other resources that are listed on Callisto's site because, you know, everyone has to do what's best for them. And so that's something that we really appreciate about the changes that have been made to Callisto's platform recently. And we think that would be really beneficial for, you know, a lot of our listeners who are current college students and survivors as they move forward. I was wondering if you can just touch a little bit more about the record form and the matching process individually, particularly something that I really like about the record form is that it was designed to essentially minimize the re-traumatization that comes with retelling of the story to all these different people, especially if you choose to support to Title IX or to the criminal justice system or even to just family or friends or whoever. So I wonder if you could expand upon that and the thought process behind that.
Yeah, I can start with this one. I have sort of the special experience of Callisto came to Stanford. It was one of the first schools that it came to several years ago. And at the time that it came, it was a very, very different product, amazing in its own right. And one component of sort of the old Callisto was that it was, in order to enter the matching system, you had to fill out the sort of an expansive record like you would do in sort of an initial intake session. I know that's sort of like the kind of phrasing or terminology that a lot of survivors go through is like an immediate session with a Title IX officer to talk about really all of the nitty-gritty details of what happened. And I think that that was sort of trying to capture the information in the old record form that was there. And one of the changes that Callisto has made in recent years in response to a lot of feedback from survivors is that, you know, for people who choose to go through the system, like the systemic process of reporting, whether it's through criminal justice or Title IX, you have to do that so much anyways. And it's so re-traumatizing. And there are so many people, quite frankly, that don't want that whole process and that want to be able to, you know if their offender has offended someone else, but, you know, doesn't want to go through the whole entire process. I mean, that's a huge, huge barrier to entry. And I think that's a big reason why sexual assault is, you know, one of the most underreported crimes. And so I think that sort of catering the intake form that we have now was one that was done like in constant collaboration. The engineers on Callisto's team were meeting with me and our other interns who are all college students, and walking through it with us, doing a lot of testing. And I mean, I think it's important to note that me and my fellow interns, you know, like I am a survivor, but I don't speak on behalf of all survivors. We all have different unique experiences. But one of the biggest things that I think Callisto has done is tried to integrate more focus groups amongst student leaders, survivors, and college students, as they've made these changes to make it as sort of as user-friendly as possible to specifically decrease the re-traumatization. And I think, too, that's something that I value about the way that it's changed is for people who haven't seen the form for Callisto, you largely just put in what identifying information you have about your perpetrator, and that includes things like social media handles or email addresses. And that's the kind of thing that is much more accessible for a lot of people. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of survivors, like I think that I've worked with and from my own personal experience, like stalking social media is a pretty sort of common response. And so you're not having to put a lot of upfront work into digging out information about them or sort of going into a deep dive of like, how do I figure out who this person is and all of these relevant details are to make sure that my match is complete. But it's pretty straightforward, which I think is really nice. And I personally feel like it's very accessible and not as re-traumatizing, which is, you know, has a lot of advantages.
So Maya, I really agree with you on the points that you made about Title IX. Having gone through the process, that initial intake is just the first of many. You go back and you revise your statements, you hear what they had to say, you go through any discrepancies between the two of you. It's a very re-traumatizing process. So that would have been something so beneficial to me in my experience, and I'm sure a bunch of other people at my college. And I'm curious to see what colleges use Callisto like around the United States, and how does a college get involved if they want to become involved with your organization?
Sure. I'd be happy to share a little bit more. We're currently on 14 campuses, and if a survivor or a college student is interested in having Callisto come to their campus, we would definitely encourage them to contact our organization and to let us know. There is a criteria to decide if the student is ready. We definitely want to know that there is a community of student organizations that are supportive of bringing Callisto to campus. We don't need a formal partnership with the campus. We are our own independent 501c3 nonprofit organization. So we're working directly with students. And yes, if students are interested in learning more or wanting to see if we can come to their campus, let us know. It is our goal is to ultimately be on every college campus and make this resource available to every college student. And making sure that every student, whether they're Black, Indigenous, people of color, LGBTQ community, trans community, we want everyone to feel like this can be for them. But we are doing it incrementally. And so we are bringing these 14 campuses on board, and slowly we'll be working our way through campuses. But I would just encourage folks to just let us know, reach out if this is of interest to you, and we will definitely work with you in that process.
Yeah, I mean, I'd add on to that. On our website, we have like a form that you can say, like, it like redirects you basically to who to like what email it should go to, basically saying like an auto response kind of thing, where you can say like, hi, this is who I am, this is what school I'm from, and I'm interested in Callisto. So there's like a direct link on the website that also makes that outreach process a little bit easier. And I'd add on to that, like a conversation that we've been having at Callisto that I think is really important is, as we think about expanding, we're also thinking about like, as we go from the colleges we're on and grow, how can we first start by being in the areas of the colleges that we're already on? Just because, you know, especially in urban areas, you know, a lot of college students socialize with students from other schools. And so in terms of being able to detect those repeat offenders, it's really valuable to be able to to look at like the region where you are and see like what your social network may be and who you're interacting with, as opposed to just your school for a lot of places. So we've been thinking about like, how can we expand, but in a way that will like continue to provide like exponentially increasing benefit for the students that are already using Callisto in terms of like increasing their odds of finding a match if there is one. And I think that's something that makes me feel really excited about the expansion process, because it's really like incentivizing to want more schools on board, not just for them and those schools and their students, but also for the other students who are already using Callisto. You know, the more people that are in that network, the more likely they are to know that they aren't alone, or to be able to find community resources that are really specific to their area, find advocacy groups that are specific to their area. And that's something that I think is a really underrated piece in survivor advocacy as a whole, is the way that your physical community in your like local area really does affect your experience in a lot of ways. So yeah, that's just something I wanted to add.
If I could add one other thing too, is that what Maya said is like right on. And I think the other piece to highlight is that there are so many nonprofit and community-based organizations that provide support in that community, and we want to work with them too. So we feel like they're a part of that whole, you know, clustering community, if you will, of campuses providing support.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just going to say, to Maya's point, I went to Barnard College, which is a part of Columbia, and there's obviously many different colleges in the city. And, you know, I have friends who have friends who go to NYU and who go to Yeshiva and who go to this place and that place. There's so many schools, particularly in New York City, but in many cities, especially like the big ones in the US, and a lot of the social life is interacted between students of different colleges and universities. So that's a really great point. I also wanted to just dive a little bit further into the matching system. So the matching system is designed to detect repeat offenders of sexual assault, which I think is really important. And I'm glad that that's kind of the focus that Callisto has taken in this tool, because repeat offenders are a very huge part of the problem, particularly on college campuses. But I mean, it does go beyond. I mean, these people eventually do leave the campus. But I just want to touch on that, because when I created Survivor Sisters, I had to do a lot of research about sexual assault on college campuses. And that was like a huge component of the problem that I found. And it reminded me of a study that I used for a research paper that I wrote on this topic. And it was a 2015 study. And it showed that 2/3 of college rapists are actually repeat offenders, and that these people constitute over 90% of the rapes that occur on college campuses each year, which are staggering numbers. And I mean, this is just one study, but many studies have, you know, kind of echoed these same results. And it's just like statistics like these that kind of show the gravity of how inadequately many universities handle sexual assault cases on their campuses, because they refuse to tackle the problem head on. And, you know, they refuse to expel students to protect their image or for whatever the case may be. And they actually end up putting more of their students in danger and perpetuating rape culture on campus. So like, this is a huge deal in terms of kind of tackling this specific issue. And so I was wondering if you guys can just talk a little bit more about that, and particularly once a match has occurred, what are the next steps there?
Yeah, I mean, so I can take on the sort of many problems that go into university response not being catered to the reality of the situation. A big piece of that being acknowledgement of repeat offenders. I think that that's one of the, as a student advocate on survivor issues, that's one of the most frustrating and common challenges I face when dealing with my university administration, is the recognition of individual cases are not independent. They are often tied to each other. And even if you aren't experiencing an instance where you have a repeat offender, it's still the recognition of the fact that these individual, even sexual assaults, they affect the community as a whole. They affect people's friends, they affect their family. And you're not just dealing ever with one person. And that's something that I feel like is really often neglected. And particularly given that there are so many repeat offenders, I think the problem right now is that so many colleges and universities are run kind of like governments, where it's like you put out one fire at a time, and it's often without looking for, you know, what the source of the fire is. And so much of it is treated as just handling case by case, often by sweeping it under the rug, unfortunately, resolving as quickly as possible. I think there's been a huge push in recent years to just always resort to informal resolutions as forms of, you know, handling sexual assault cases, which isn't always a bad thing. A lot of times that's because that is what the survivor wants. But it is, I think, something that universities don't invest the upfront but long-term beneficial work of how do you root this out as a culture. And one way is thinking a lot more consciously about the fact that repeat offenders are common. And unfortunately, universities know this. You know, this isn't rocket science. And even like I've had some frustrating conversations with students and staffers at Stanford who have said like, oh yeah, we have a file of frequent flyers is what they called it, that are just people they know. They've been through the system multiple times. I think this is also especially a huge problem with staff and professors too, where it's just the same members of these institutions that stay there for years and years and years and continue to be offenders. And it's really damaging. And there's been kind of a numbness to it, I think, at least in my experience with my university, of that's just the way it is. We get frequent flyers. We get people who go through the system multiple times, and there's nothing we can do about it. And that's not true. There are things you can do about it. And providing systems of accountability is something that is complex, and you have to do thoughtfully, and you have to do it in a way too that doesn't, you know, just like increase the school to prison pipeline, or doesn't just resort automatically to leaving these people out in the dust with no options where they're likely to repeat again anyways, and just not on your campus, but just on someone else's campus, or, you know, in another community that they go to afterwards. It is a lot of work. It's hard, but it's the kind of thing where it's about creating sustainable solutions towards actually ending cultures of violence. And that's something that I think very few campuses themselves are putting in the work to do, unfortunately. And so that relies a lot on students and student advocates, and then on sort of external sources like Callisto in this case, to be able to come in and sort of be supportive systems in the way that they can when colleges fail to be the advocates that survivors need.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the last part that you were saying, where like a lot of it falls on the students and the survivors. Just like something that I just noticed, like I'm sure most people are aware that there are repeat offenders, and that it's more than likely that the person who has violated you has violated someone else. There was actually a Twitter movement in the summer where people were calling out their abusers by name. And there was so many people, like if you just looked at the comments, they would be like, he did it to me too. He did it to me too. And just like seeing that movement, like how empowering it is. It was also just like a disgrace, because you hear these stories about how these repeat offenders, they just keep getting away with it. And that the schools, like as much as they try to do something, like it just doesn't seem like they're doing enough to get rid of this prevalent problem.
Yeah, it is. And it's really hard and unfortunate to see. And it also, when you see so many of those instances as a survivor, even just as an ally, as a student, it gets to a point where it's hard to believe that your university really is trying. You know, like it's hard to believe all the messages you receive from your university that they want the campus to be free of sexual assault and things like that. When you see, oh, you let the same person go through your Title IX process, you know, X number of times, and you know that they're still on the campus with no consequences, like continuing to be a safety threat. It's hard to trust them, I think, and that creates so much institutional betrayal. And that, like, for a lot of survivors I've worked with, the institutional betrayal and feeling like your school doesn't actually care about you and isn't working to fight for you is in some ways can be a worse trauma than the assault at times, just because that's so, I mean, talk about trust issues, like first being having something where you lose trust in someone else and then having a whole system that you're realizing isn't designed for you. I mean, that is next level trauma that we aren't really doing enough work to address.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially like the institutional betrayal is a huge component of why people don't report, why they don't go to Title IX, why they don't go to the criminal justice system, even sometimes why, I mean, this isn't necessarily institutional, but it's indicative of who we are as a society, why they don't tell their family or friends or their peers, because they're so afraid of the judgment and stigma. And oftentimes, you know, the reality is these cases don't go the way that they're supposed to go. They have little to no benefit to the survivor when it's all said and done, and they're only just left even more traumatized to begin with, you know, having to retell their story, having to be told that, you know, this wasn't violent enough to be considered rape or assault, or, you know, to have any sort of action being taken, or are you sure that you did this, to constantly being questioned over and over again, which is why organizations like Callisto, having these resources is so important, like having a record form to avoid that if you choose to go through that process is something that could be so valuable. You know, having a matching system to try and tackle this issue when universities seem so unwilling to do so is, you know, something that at least can help the problem in some way, maybe not institutionally as a whole and kind of create that systemic change, but to have some sort of support or guidance with a legal options counselor if there is a match and so forth. And so that's something that we really need to work on. That's something that I definitely found through all of the research that I did. It's disheartening. I'm not a survivor, but just doing this work as an ally and an advocate for survivors, it makes me angry. It really does. And I know a lot of people feel the same sentiment. It's frustrating. It's hurtful. And a lot of students feel like they're not protected and that their university doesn't care about them, which is a huge problem.
Yeah, I think too, in terms of from like a perspective in terms of like how you disrupt this, it also becomes a really challenging cycle where just as an advocate, I have a lot of survivors that come to me and it sucks and it feels horrible having to tell them like, hey, you could report to the Title IX office, but I do need to give you all these disclaimers that it will probably be a horrible experience. And you likely won't get the kind of justice you're looking for. So you just have to know that going in. I mean, that's a horrible thing to have to tell people. And I think, too, that in terms of being very frequently on the other end of working with administration and trying to create kind of policy change, one of the most frustrating things that I've experienced is, you know, administrators will say to me like, oh, well, we haven't had students go through this process or tell us that this was a problem, or like, we haven't had enough people tell us that this was an experience that they had. So how can we know that it's actually a problem or that we actually change it? And it's like, well, yeah, students are scared to go through these processes or are scared to communicate these issues because it's so toxic and because they've already experienced this betrayal. So yeah, I mean, no kidding, like reporting numbers like often dwindle after sort of bad instances on campuses because people realize like, oh, the university didn't do anything, so why would I go forward and report? And then the university gets the signal of like, oh, fewer people are reporting sexual assault. That's great. That must mean we handled it well and that it's not happening anymore. And no. And so it makes it really hard to be able to identify problems and create those solutions when you just aren't even getting the data because the system is so broken, people can't even like invest in it at all.
And I wanted to add that, you know, I think that's why we created the matching to empower survivors, that if you're not getting the support that you need, that you could use our system in a very secure way, very confidential, and that, you know, it can be a daunting process. And so if you want to protect yourself and your community, and you want to see if that serial perpetrator can be identified, the best way to be able to figure out what the process is like is to talk to someone, right? And for us, that's why we identified and brought in legal options counselors. And I think for survivors to know what their rights are and to know what the options may look like, and to be able to talk to someone and talk through, like, what are the implications if I choose this route versus another, right? To be able just to talk through and just figure out what that could look like, what those scenarios could look like. I think that's why we wanted to incorporate legal options counselors to our process, and to have individuals, so lawyers, that would have attorney-client privilege, so they can't divulge that, right? That's an important piece to this. And that they have experience working with survivors. So they're caring, empathetic, and they're there really for them, right? And so I think that's why I'm so excited for us to have this new addition, because I think it will really help support survivors throughout that process.
I mean, it's really important that, you know, anyone who kind of included this conversation and in this process to be trauma-informed, to maintain privacy and confidentiality, and to ultimately respect, you know, the wishes of the survivor and what they choose to do and maintain their autonomy. That's so important and something that we really value about Callisto and how you've kind of put that at the forefront of the organization and the services and resources that you provide. I have a question for Maya in particular, just as a current student on a campus that is currently using Callisto and the different, you know, organizations that you're involved with on campus regarding sexual assault and sexual violence. How has the response been from the people that you've worked with on campus? And basically just kind of how has it manifested on Stanford's campus?
Yeah, I mean, I think something that I think speaks a lot of volumes is the people that I talk to the most that are like familiar with and recommend and utilize Callisto are student RAs. On our campus, like our RAs are very active members of the community in like a non-penalizing kind of way. There's usually really close relationships between residents and their RAs. It's not like at a lot of schools where that's like very much a disciplinary role. It's really more kind of like it's like more community mentors that are on campus. And so the fact that that's like a resource that they are ones that often recommend, I think, is what gave me confidence in Callisto when it came to Stanford. And as it started becoming popular there, is they're often the people, one of the first people that students report to. They are mandatory reporters. And so, you know, it does sometimes involve then students having to go through the Title IX process. It also can just mean that the Title IX process reaches out, the Title IX office reaches out to them and says, do you want to make a report, yes or no? And you can ignore them. You can say no, you know, whatever. But the fact that oftentimes those trusted sort of first response community members have recommended Callisto, I think has shown to me that it's something that is valuable for people and is working for people. And like complete honesty, Callisto has undergone all of these changes really recently. And I think that because we are all online, that communication about like what those changes are, and it's become a lot harder. And so just to be completely honest, the dynamic will probably be different in terms of like how students at Stanford's campus react to the new Callisto, what people tend to use it, you know, what sort of those initial reviews are. We don't know that yet, but I'm feeling optimistic that people will feel happy about it and that they will, you know, feel like it's new and improved.
But correct me if I'm wrong, one of the improvements that you guys made was excluding Title IX from your process with Callisto, right? Can you guys talk about that decision more, and then why you guys came to that decision to exclude Title IX, and what's your process like now without them?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So as I understand it, is that we sought the feedback of our survivors and students in terms of what was best for them. And they, as Maya has already shared, in terms of the challenges with Title IX offices, we felt it was really important to be able to work directly with students and give the students the agency to decide how to proceed. So beforehand, you know, working with the schools in a formal way, in a formal contract, required us to give the information to the campuses, right? And in this manner, students really decide they can still report to Title IX, right? They can still go to Title IX in our current format, but it's their choice. It's the survivor's choice. Whereas before it was part of the process, right? It was standard that it would go to Title IX. So that's a big part of the reason why we shifted that over. And as Maya said, I mean, it does require us to really be intentional about how we build awareness across a campus now, right? Because we are working one student at a time, if you will. And that's very different than working with the whole system. But at the same time, I think that I do feel really confident about our student advocates on campus that can help disseminate the information more effectively within their groups and their circles to know that we're available. So yeah, that was part of the decision. Maya, do you want to add anything else to that?
Yes. So as I heard that Calista was changing, and then I found out that sort of a critical change was them disassociating from the Title IX office, that actually is like what inspired me to want to come work for Calista. And it's the thing that I'm most passionate about in terms of the changes that Calista has made. Because as Antonia mentioned, it makes it a lot harder for Calista to be able to spread the word when you aren't using the institutional benefits of the Title IX office. But I do think that it's really because it makes it so much more beneficial for students. And instead of putting the work on the students, it puts the work on Calista. And so I really wanted to be involved in like helping Calista with that process so that it would then in turn be more beneficial to students. And, you know, we talked a little bit about that institutional betrayal being such a traumatizing part of the experience. And I think that for me, you know, I haven't actually, I'm a survivor, but I haven't gone through the Title IX process at Stanford, but I have worked with so many students who have, that anything that my Title IX office was paying for or promoting, I just always take with a grain of salt and go in with a lot of distrust to it. And I do think that Calista was effective at Stanford, even having that connection to the Title IX office, but that it just is so much easier to sell something that you know has no obligation to your university whatsoever. You know that they are there to serve you. They have no, you know, they have no sort of cars in that race. And that they're separated from the university. The people, they don't have to sign a contract. And so, you know, if an administrator at my school gets frustrated with the way that a case is going because of how a survivor used Calista, they can't call Antonia and be like, hey, change that. You know, like they have no power over them. They're completely different entities. And I think that is just so, so important because it's really hard as a survivor to find resources that are specific to your campus and like know the intricacies of your campus dynamics and policies, but that you can actually trust. And that is just, that's something that I think I'm really passionate about, is like, I want there to be as many sort of external resources that are available to college students like Calista and, you know, a myriad of others that can be sort of at students' disposal, that they know that those organizations are working for them and that they're liable to them and that that's it. And the universities and all of their conflicted interests have no stake in the game. And that's just something that I think is the most passionate piece of Calista that's changed that I am, but I have, that was not, I did not speak correctly, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. Like just hearing everything you're saying, like I totally 100% agree. And like, I'm someone who did go through the Title IX process and I didn't have Calista for me. I had something called VPVA, but like you said, it's tied to the campus. So I often felt frustrated with the resources I was getting because there are certain things that they couldn't do for me because the campus wouldn't allow it, certain things that they couldn't help me with. And like everything was kind of motivated based on like making Rutgers look good and making everything like kind of just like sweep under the rug. And like, while the people who work there are like so passionate and like, are unfortunately like they have to make a living, and this is an unfortunate circumstance that they were put in where they're kind of limited by their job. Something like Callisto would just seem so beneficial and such a game changer for so many people's lives. And I'm interested to hear about like some of the feedback that survivors using Callisto have given you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of as I mentioned, Callisto has really just in the last several months gone under this whole relaunch and all of these sort of different changes completely altering their product. And I think that's made it hard to sort of get the magnitude of student response that we want in terms of, you know, there are a lot of people like at Stanford who use the old Callisto and really liked it and are feeling sort of hesitant of like, oh my God, you changed things and don't necessarily know what those changes are. But, you know, there's so much that changes in the landscape of sexual violence policy and culture and things like that, that change can be a really scary thing. And in terms of services for survivors, like, I think that's something that if you hear a platform you once trusted is undergoing changes, it's easy because of all of the betrayal that you've experienced to just kind of assume it's for the worst and be like, oh my God, why did they do that? I liked it how it was. It must be bad now. And so we haven't gotten necessarily, at least in my experience, people who use old Callisto and have now used new Callisto and been like, oh, that's bad. I think all of the people that I've talked to that I've experienced new Callisto have really liked it as students. But I think we've struggled to access students and get them on board who, at least in my experience, who have used the old Callisto because of that barrier of change. And so, I mean, like part of the reason that I wanted to be able to be part of this conversation today is, you know, it takes a survivor, it takes an advocate, it takes someone you trust telling you like, hey, this changed and it is scary, but it's for the best and it is for good things. And here are all of the benefits that you can have now. And I think that's one of the challenges that just Callisto is having in terms of being able to spread that message for campuses that use the old Callisto of like, hey, we changed, but it's a good thing. And we changed because of survivor feedback. And that it was really popular with survivors beforehand. And I think the core of what made it so popular beforehand is still there. So it's just communicating that. Like, I know we have a lot of information about like all of the data we had from students who'd used Callisto, like 10 out of 10 students that have used Callisto said that they would recommend it to a friend and things like that. But all of that data now, because it's with the old product, I think we're trying to stay authentic to the fact that it has changed so much and kind of like recollect all of that data from the start. So it's really reflective of what the service actually is and isn't misleading for people. And that honestly, that's been a challenge because it is so new. And the fact that this is all happening too during the pandemic where, like, I think like from survivors that I've talked to that have experienced assault since the pandemic, like the last thing on their minds right now is like wanting to figure out how to report it when, especially if you're not on campus. And so it feels like distant. You're not even sure if like the law applies to you because you're not on your campus anymore. There's all of the federal changes. Like there's just so much confusion and there's so much else on people's plates right now that, you know, in my experience, like any reason you can tell a survivor that's like a good reason not to report or a good reason not to have to talk about something, your brain just when you go through trauma takes it. You're like, oh, okay, great. Like this is a reason why I shouldn't be talking about this, or this is a reason why I shouldn't be reporting this. This is a reason why I shouldn't be taking action on this yet. Okay, great. Like I'm going to do that because it's a pandemic and I'm going to do that because I have too much on my plate. And I think that's been the case for so many people right now is they just don't have the bandwidth to go through like a huge reporting process and go through looking into all of the resources at their disposal. You know, obviously that's not the case for everyone, but so I do think that that has sort of been a really impactful piece of like how we've been able to elicit student feedback.
If I could add as well, is that a couple of things is that we launched a new website literally just a couple weeks ago. And that was informed by survivors, like how to make that, you know, work for them. And so I would encourage any of your listeners to check out our website, right? And give us your feedback through that process and tell us, does this work for you? Does this resonate with you? Is it helpful? Because that feedback helps us make it even better, right? So there are so many ways in which survivors and allies and advocates can give us feedback. even though we're a new product, right? I think we are wanting to do surveys and informal conversations and focus groups throughout the year as we build out these communities across the country, you know, these regions. So there are plenty of opportunity for individuals to give us some of their feedback about what they think about the new product. The other thing I wanted to share, as college campuses are in this hybrid format, right, of like some of them are only online and some of them are a couple of, you know, a certain percentage of students are on campuses. We have to really pivot and say, how can we best serve survivors in this situation? And so social media is a really significant way in which we can reach out to survivors and allies and students, right, through Instagram and other forms. And I think the other thing too is that we're looking at how can we place an ambassador on each of our affiliate campuses that will work closely with us, kind of like the interns, kind of like Maya's working with us, that we have someone on the ground that can really inform us about what works for your campus, who are the students we need to talk to, how can we disseminate this information. And so soon we'll be unveiling that, you know, and rolling that out. And I think having an ambassador at each of the campuses will just be a great way for us to work together and figure out how to spread that message, because we do want to build that trust. We want everyone to know that we're here for you. And so any feedback that we can receive along the way is like greatly appreciated and beneficial to improving what we do.
Yes. Well, number one, definitely check out their website. It looks great, by the way. And there's just a lot of different resources, whether you choose to report or not. I think that you guys have done a great job at really, you know, taking survivors' feedback into consideration and making changes for the better. While obviously we haven't used the old Callisto or had any sort of contact with it, that institutional betrayal and the mistrust that kind of transfers to anyone who's kind of associated with Title IX and the universities as a whole is really real and is valid. And I think that ultimately it will be a change for the better, just because I know so many people, and we've had so many survivors reach out to us, the people who have come on to our podcast to share their story have experienced that and or have, you know, avoided going that route because of that and the experiences of others that they've heard about, and that they just want to avoid that completely because they don't want to put themselves through that. So ultimately, I think that, you know, it's a change for the better, and it allows survivors to kind of take back their voice and their own choices and develop a relationship of trust with Callisto and with other external organizations. I think that's really important as well, because there is so much mistrust, and not just with Title IX, but with many other parts of the puzzle here. But, you know, speaking of social media and technology, I think it's really important that, you know, we talk about how technology, specifically as a result of the pandemic, has been leveraged to address the shifting landscape of sexual assault advocacy in particular, but I think it also applies to all social justice movements and activism and advocacy work. And I was wondering if either of you had any sort of input on that. Maya, I know being a current student and also being involved in advocacy work both on campus and off, what has your experience been like in the pandemic in terms of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's so challenging. And I think the pandemic has really revealed that all of the problems that we have in society and in all of our localities, on campuses, sort of you name it, are just being exacerbated right now. And something that comes to mind for me specifically when you talk about survivors and sexual violence prevention is that, you know, one of the most common feelings associated with sexual assault is isolation and loneliness and kind of feeling on your own and all of those things that are so disconnected from the people around you. I know for me, like, disassociation was one of the strongest like side effects after my assault that I had, and that becomes so much harder when the entire world is isolated right now and when everything else is you know, not is disassociated, and it just makes it so much more challenging, I think, to be able to find that support that you need when those feelings can be exacerbated. And, you know, on top of the assault, people are going through so many other things too. Like, just everything is hard right now. And it's just one more hard thing that I think people don't want to have to deal with and shouldn't have to. And so I think in terms of the experience of survivors, that's really challenging. There's, of course, then too, the like logistical details of, you know, we saw right when the pandemic started, a couple months after, there was some light shined on intimate partner violence and how scary that is during the pandemic for people who are now being forced to stay and work at home with violent partners or people that make them feel unsafe at home. I think that's true too of, you know, all kinds of domestic violence. Children in violent situations are really struggling right now. And, you know, that's true for when we talk about college campuses. I think something that a population that's often neglected is grad students. And, you know, married grad students or grad students in partnerships that are living with dangerous people right now are really looking for support. And there isn't a lot out there for them, which is really hard. And even students on college campuses, like, you know, I know for me, a lot of students reacted to the pandemic by like living in houses off campus with other students. So that way they can continue to sort of have kind of a college experience. That's where I am now. I'm living with some friends off campus. And that's a great opportunity for a lot of people. But the downside is that when you move off campus then, and when you're disconnected from the university and your housing, you also lose the support and the resources and the understanding that, you know, if you get assaulted in those situations, your school still does have an obligation to help you, or it should, depending on how they reacted to the DeVos regulations. But it's hard to recognize that, and it's hard to feel that. And especially if you're quarantining, and if you're quarantining with a fellow student who assaults you, that's really scary because you feel trapped because so many of us are stuck right now. And that's something that I think I spend a lot of time thinking about, is how can advocates and allies support those people, and how can we be acknowledging of what's going on right now, and the fact that it is heightening situations that were already bad, making them worse, and how do we access these people that are feeling more isolated than usual. And I think that social media has been an interesting way to be able to try and leverage that, and technology as a whole, because it is the kind of thing where, you know, if you're on campus and you get assaulted and you decide you want to report it or take action, or even if it's not even in the form of a formal report, like, you know what resources are on your campus, and you decide, like, you know, if you want to go to a counseling service, then you can, you know, walk down to wherever that is and try that out. Or if you want to, you know, go talk to your friends in another part of campus, you can sort of go out and do that. And with those options really limited, it's all kind of either just been erased completely or moved online. And it's important that we get as many of those things to a virtual setting as possible, so people aren't left in the dust. And, you know, so that's the sort of like direct survivor support angle of it. And then I think the other piece of it too is advocacy. And at least for me, like, that's been a crazy challenge for me since the pandemic started, as an advocate of, you know, most of my organizing I did physically on campus by talking to students in like public areas, distributing materials, like sort of sitting out there with information, like talking to people in different social settings. Like, it was so in-person based. And like my advocacy group on campus, like, had to make an Instagram for the first time, you know, when the pandemic started. And that's the kind of thing where honestly, we should have done that a lot earlier, but there was really no choice once the pandemic started. If we wanted to keep doing advocacy, it had to move to social media. And that comes with a whole layer of challenges and also benefits. You know, a lot of the people in our generation, I think, are talking a lot about like how virtue signaling becomes a problem when you're talking about social media advocacy. And that's definitely something that I think the survivor rights movement is challenged by, in terms of like also reckoning too, when we post about sexual assault, how are we cognizant of how it affects more marginalized communities? And that's something that I think social media has kind of forced us into learning how to do, often by a lot of people doing it wrong, unfortunately. But that's kind of helped us become stronger. And like from my experience, you know, I am not a graphic designer, and I never thought that like being good at making Instagram posts would be a skill set that I needed in order to be an effective advocate. And all of a sudden, now it is. It's like in my advocate group, that is by far the number one demand we most have, is like, okay, we made all this information. How do we make it into an Instagram post? Like, that is just a surreal way to be able to message to people, and can be really, really challenging. But I also think has a lot of positive rewards too. I mean, social media, the upside of it is you know, despite all of the isolation that we are all in, it's much easier to build a network and reach more people through the lens of social media because that barrier to entry is just smaller. And so the amount of people that in the work that I've done, we've been able to spread our message to, the amount of people on campus that we now have like awareness of and relationships with has honestly increased drastically since the pandemic, because when we're messaging through social media, it can just be so easily reshared, sent forward. It just, the number of eyes it hits is so much larger than any single event we hold on campus. And that's been a really important thing for us to be able to realize. And that I think will continue to stick for advocates long after the pandemic, is how you utilize social media to get a more diverse audience, a more representative audience. You know, a lot of times our events before the pandemic, it was like, you know, me and my friends' friends and the other advocates, their friends and their friends' friends. And that's, you know, a pretty siloed group of allies and of kind of the same types of people. And so to a certain extent, you kind of stop reaching your maximum value in terms of what you're able to put out and be able to get in support and the amount of sort of mobilizing you're allowed to do when your sort of like audience is just only so big and is only the same amount of people. And, you know, now it's greatly expanded and we're able to actually be able to communicate with a much like with students on the campus who come from much more different walks of life and come from different experiences. And it's just because someone shared our post on their story. And so they were able to DM us and say like, hey, I'm a first gen student and I'm experiencing this problem. Or like, I'm an international student and experienced stalking. What do I do? And those are the kinds of things that, you know, those are the stories we may not have been able to hear and the people we may not have been able to effectively advocate before the pandemic, but social media has allowed us to connect with them in a really powerful way that I'm super grateful for.
The only thing I would add is that you can also do events, right? Online events. And I think that has also broadened the scope to invite individuals. So it's not only, it doesn't have to only be your campus anymore. You can invite sister organizations to join in and it broadens it and creates a greater awareness and a more diverse awareness as well.
Yeah, I mean, on our end, you know, we've seen our social media continue to grow all throughout the pandemic. I mean, even like many other people, the beginning of the pandemic especially was really hard and it was really difficult. We didn't know, you know, how are we going to navigate this? And we took a long break, probably about almost 6 to 8 months, I would say. It was a pretty significant break. And even during that time, though, we saw our social media continue to grow. We saw people find our podcast and reach out to us and say, hey, I just found out about your podcast. This is so amazing. Or, you know, it's a good resource for us, and connecting with other organizations and many survivors all across the world, which has been super rewarding. And social media definitely has its negatives, but it also has so many positives that's what we try to focus on here at Survivor Sisters. Obviously, we've existed in tech from our inception. You know, we started the podcast in, I believe it was September 2019. So just about like 6 months or so before the pandemic. And we've continued to grow since then, but now podcasting and social media and all forms of media really are, you know, blowing up and people are seeking that out. And we honestly feel like it's made a lot of this information a lot more accessible to people, which is so important. And while it comes with its negatives, I do feel like there's so many amazing organizations and survivors personally who are using their social media platforms to educate other people, to advocate for other people. And also, I want to point out that when we see these movements, these social justice movements kind of shift to more online activism and advocacy work, I think it opens the opportunity to form connections with one another and to address the intersectionality within so many of these different movements. I mean, especially, you know, when we're talking about sexual violence and domestic violence, we have to consider, how does race play a role in this? How does sexuality play a role in this? How does, you know, gender identity? And that's something that we've always tried to do before, you know, the pandemic, but something that is, we have become much more acutely aware of since then. I think that a lot of people are in a similar situation. So I think that it's important if you are currently struggling right now, if you feel like you need more resources or you need more connection, that's valid. But there are so many resources and people and accounts and events and all these different things available to you. And people are putting in the work, which is so important to continue to make those connections to support one another, even in this like virtual landscape. And I know that we've connected with so many people. So it really kind of opens up, you know, the scope of the impact that you can make and the support that you can give to others. And so that's really important as well.
Something you said that really, really inspired me is that there are so many people out there. And I think another side effect of the pandemic is that people have really realized what's important to them and like the ways that they want to spend their time and how that can be as meaningful as possible. So I know for me personally, like, I spend way less time now on my schoolwork than ever and way more time on my advocacy because being in the pandemic has made me realize, you know, in the long term, this is what's going to make a difference in people's lives. And this is how I can use my skill set to be able to support people where they are and how they're really struggling. And, you know, me doing stats homework isn't that. And so I'm going to spend less time doing that. And as much as my parents don't always love that, you know, I think that it's common for a lot of people in the advocacy sphere right now to be giving so many more hours and to putting in so much more and thinking so much more thoughtfully to how they're doing their work, because we've just realized how important it is and how much more important it is than the other things we spent too much time on in our lives before the pandemic. And so I do think that there is a huge network out there of people who really, really do care and who are putting in so much work and really, really want to be able to help. And when there's so much misery and unhappiness in the world, really want to be able to be a source of good for other people and support. And so, you know, I just, that's sort of a point of optimism that I think it's easy to forget about, but there are so many people out there who I think really, really do want to make survivors feel, you know, less isolated and supported and advocated for. And that's really important.
I totally agree with you. I think the pandemic has definitely changed that perspective and has made everyone like kind of realize what's more important to them. I know for me, just like a personal thing that I'm doing, I'm going to be getting my victim advocacy training. So like, that's something I'm stepping forward to. And like just being in school during the pandemic while I'm in grad school, like, it just kind of made me like realize how important this is. And like, that's what I'm going to do with my life. I want to dedicate it to survivors and helping survivors. And I think because this pandemic is so lonely and like, there's so much going on in our lives, it's kind of hard to feel like there are people there for you, especially when you're a survivor of sexual assault. So I think Callisto, people like you guys are honestly like the reason why people keep going. Like, you really show like that there are good humans in there and that there's faith in the system, and it's just an amazing work that you guys do.
That's amazing, Adriana. And that, I mean, that goes back to you two both too, and creating this podcast, I think, is helping a lot of people feel less alone right now. And I just want to thank you for all of the work that you two are putting in also. And I think you've been able to see that since the pandemic, is that it's just so much more meaningful to people. And I just wanted to thank you for that.
I just wanted to echo that. I really am inspired by the work that you do, Adriana and Dominique, to provide that voice and that space for survivors. And I'd really love to share with survivors and allies that there's a lot going on, but there's no expiration date, you know, to do something when you're ready. Even when all the noise settles, and it's only you, and you hear that you need to do something about what you experienced, then that's the time for it. And we're going to be there, right? Callisto's going to be there ready and when you're ready. And so I just wanted to share that because it's never too late. It's never, you know, it doesn't matter. It really, what matters most is when you're ready that you can then do something and the resources are there.
Exactly. There's no expiration date. You can do something if you choose to. If you don't want to do something, you know, that's on you as well. It's all about choice and autonomy. And I think the changes that Callisto has made to really honor that is so important. And yeah, I mean, we want to thank you guys as well. Like, it's just been really inspiring to connect with you guys. I mean, we have met so many people along the way, and especially in this landscape, to see how they're pivoting their own advocacy work, how they're, you know, processing their traumas and how they're going through that has just been really inspiring for us as well. And it's, you know, why we keep going and keep doing what we're doing. So I think this has been such an amazing conversation. I just want to close. This is something that we usually ask all of our guests. What do you guys hope for the future of Callisto, the future, Maya, for you, for your personal advocacy work? And what are some things that you hope to accomplish and expand upon for Callisto?
You know, my hope is that survivors, and not only survivors, but allies and family members and communities know how to be supportive of one another. One of the things that we're now working on is how to create content for allies, and how can a survivor have that really challenging conversation with their families, right? And my hope is that we will continue to share more information to support more individuals and create a very broad community that has more information now than they ever did, and that they know, they feel more confident about how to support survivors. And that's my like personal opinion around that. But also as an organization, we just want to provide the best product that resonates, that is in service of survivors, and that we can open it up to whomever wants it ultimately, right? That's where we're going to have a greatest impact, and really try to do our part in the prevalence of assault in our community.
Yeah, I want to echo that. And in terms of my hope for Callisto, I think I just hope it can be an added source of trust. I think there's just not enough trust in the entire experience that survivors go through from start to, I would say start to finish, but there is no finish. There's no end of trauma. And there need to be more places where you can feel secure, resources where you know, don't have to be second guessing everything, and you don't have to be wondering if this is going to work out for you, or if you can be betrayed, or, you know, all of the myriad of questions that it's so easy to feel after a traumatic event like assault. And I hope that Callisto, as it continues to change and evolve, can be most importantly just a reliable source that's a resource people can trust. And yeah, I agree. I mean, ideally it's like can be accessible to anyone. It's something that you can, you know, reach out to an LLC whenever you want. And it's something that, you know, every student at any college campus can have access to, and that someone in every friend group knows about Callisto. I think that's a phrase that my coworker, who I love, Lauren, coined, was that she wants everyone in every friend group, there were to be one person in every friend group who knows about Callisto. And I think that that's, in terms of from the Callisto side of things, a great goal to work towards. I mean, I think personally, like Adriana, what you said really resonated with me. I've realized that survivor advocacy is going to be part of my life's mission forever. And I hope that, you know, when I leave the world, it is a more safe place for women, queer people of color, survivors of all types, where there's less assault, where it is just safer, more equitable. And, you know, I want to be part of making that happen. I have a particular focus on policy and civil rights policy. And so hope that I can use that skill set to be able to be effective in that regard. But mostly, you know, I just hope that we can continue to all be sort of like working together, building awareness around this and acting from a place of moving forward and supporting each other and making sure that like historically silenced voices and survivors who are silenced have a platform to vocalize and to be heard and to feel comfortable in their skin and with their voice. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Yes, very, very well said. And that, you know, that's the goal of Survivor Sisters as well. Like, we want to be a platform for all survivors of all different backgrounds to kind of take back their voice and share their stories and just, you know, refuse to be silenced. There's so many people, institutions, whatever, that are trying to silence your voice, and it's not right. And we need more, you know, organizations, we need more platforms where survivors can do that and take back their voice and take back their autonomy. And so that's why I'm really excited to have had you guys on. And yeah, you can check out Callisto. Their website is mycallisto.org, and you can follow them on Instagram at Callisto. We will have all of their like information linked on our social media. At Survivor Sisters is our Instagram handle. And we'll also be sure to include a list of the current college campuses that are actively using Callisto. And if you, you know, feel like you want to get involved and have Callisto come onto your campus, we will provide information on how you can contact Callisto and try to set that up and make something happen in that regard. But yeah, thank you guys so much for coming on here. You can listen to Survivor Sisters anywhere. You can subscribe to podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. We also post on YouTube. We have merch that we sell in our Teespring store that's linked in our bio, and we donate the proceeds of that to different nonprofit organizations that combat sexual assault. Thank you everyone for listening, and we hope to see you guys next time.
We will not be silenced.